Hi, my name is Mandy Jackson Beverly, and I'm a bibliophile. Welcome to the bookshop. Barbara Peters founded The Poison Pen in 1989. With her husband Robert Rosenwald, she gambled on Poison Pen Press in 1997. Barbara has won the Raven and Quill Awards from the Mystery Writers of America and been nominated for an Edgar for Best Biographical Work and is a Boucher Khan Fan Guest of Honor and Lifetime Achievement Honoree, as well as a Lifetime Honoree from Malice Domestic, an annual fan convention which celebrates traditional mystery. Hi, Barbara, and welcome to the show.
Good morning. Well, in your case, whatever time it is, thank you very much for having me.
My pleasure. Barbara, you were born in Evanston and raised in Winnetka, Illinois, and hold a bachelor's degree from Stanford University, an MA in history from Northwestern University, a master's of library science from the University of Tennessee, and you read the law in Virginia. That's a diverse academic background and one gained in multiple states. Why the choice to settle in Scottsdale, Arizona?
Well, it's such a long story. I'm not going to go into it. It was a medical decision. I had a serious medical incident when I was 40 years old. And as a result, by the time the trial was over, which I won, I needed to live in a different climate. I have a paralyzed leg, so I need to live in a warm, dry climate. But I also was forcibly retired from the other things that I did. And while I resettled in Arizona, I met my present husband, who we've been married 30 years. And one day he said to me, now that you can do whatever you want, what is it you're going to do? And I thought about the other things I had done in my life. And the thing I loved the best, as always loved the best, was reading. And I was a librarian at the Library of Congress. I was nominated to their intern program, which is, again, unfortunately, no longer something offered at the library. And groomed to take a management position at the library. But I was also a single mom then, and the cost of living in the District of Columbia with two young children and being gone all the time was so prohibitive that I moved over and read the law in Virginia. And all of that culminated in the medical incident. And so I came to Scottsdale, where my parents lived, and I met my husband. And when he said, what is it you want to do? I said, I want to go back to books because I loved it the best. And he said, we're not moving to Washington. And I said, okay, since I don't have to work, why don't I just open a little bookstore for fun? And apparently my personality does not allow me to do anything just for fun. So now it's a big bookstore with 19 employees and, you know, what can I say? But it's a not-for-profit bookstore, and I think people should be aware of that. And I've been, because I don't have any financial stake in it, personal financial stake in it, I've always enjoyed running it the way I want to. I take a lot of risks, but they're all managed risks. And we do a lot of diverse things that if I were really looking at a bottom line, at least for me, although I'm really serious about it for my staff because they live on it, it probably wouldn't be the way it is. So, you know, I was 50 when I started it. I'm 80 and a half now. I've learned to do a lot of things that I wasn't prepared for, but the legal training and the library training really came together and made it possible to think about growing this little hobby of a bookstore, which was like 600 square feet when we started, and now it's most of a building in Scottsdale. And it's just been great. And my husband didn't need to work, and he really loved the whole idea. So eventually, about 10 years after we started the bookstore, no, 8 years after, he decided to start a publishing company called Poison Pen Press. And we had a lot of fun with that for about 20 years. But we just didn't have the capital, or we were too old. You know, we just didn't think that we wanted to truly invest in the kind of thing you need to invest in to run a publishing company. And so we sold it to Sourcebooks in January of 2019. And they've carried on with the Poison Pen Press imprint and done a lot of great things with it that we were never going to do. And now the bookstore has gotten so big, my husband works at the bookstore. But it doesn't really work for me. Nobody really works for me. Everybody owns part of the bookstore.
You mentioned earlier that the Poison Pen is a not-for-profit bookshop. How does that work?
Well, I mean, legally speaking, a not-for-profit would be a complicated thing because you'd then have to have a board of directors and oversight and a particular tax thing. We do have a foundation that is actually a 501c3 foundation that people can donate to. And it the work that we did with the foundation kind of came to a halt with COVID because a lot of it was intended to send authors to conferences or to workshops where they could grow their craft or bring authors to Scottsdale to give a hand to other authors. And so there it is. So basically what it is that I get no compensation. So when I say it's not for profit, what that really means is that the owner, CEO, who is me, gets absolutely no income from the bookstore. And in fact, often subsidizes various activities that go, because we're famous for taking authors out to dinner. And the pandemic has saved me a personal fortune because, I mean, it's been wonderful. But over the years, because it's been a very social kind of a thing, particularly for me, we've been able, J.T. Ellison, the thriller writer known as Thrillatrix, said to me the other day, she said, you know what you have? She said, you have relationships to draw on. You've gotten through the pandemic so well because you've had such great relationships with authors that you've been able to continue to function almost exactly as you did before the pandemic, whereas many bookstores were focused on books rather than authors. My staff are focused on books, but I've actually always been focused on authors. I love meeting them. I love helping them. There's probably a list of 100 bestsellers today who have started their book tours, book promotion at the Poison Pen, many of whom have always signed their books at the Poison Pen all the way through their whole career. So we could talk to Michael Connelly at one end, and we could talk to Jack Carr, who is brand new, but into book four. And, you know, if you have that kind of history with authors where you've always supported them and they always remember the person who loved them first or love them when nobody knew who they were. You know, I mean, it doesn't do you any good to go leaping in when somebody's already become well-known or celebrated or won awards or, you know, they're all different standards about what a successful author is, depending on how the author wants to measure it or how you want to measure it. But if you were there before anybody else knew or cared, they remember that. And we remember that. And then we stay loyal to them. If we started with them, we always try to keep up with them. Sometimes life intervenes. Sometimes an author stops touring or who knows, you know. Some people, not everybody when they become celebrated remembers their roots, so to speak. But that's a very small percentage of authors. You know, most people don't go into writing books for the money. I mean, you know, it's become more of a thing since 1989 when I started, because there's a lot of really big money washing around now in book publishing, not so much then. But most people go into writing because they have a story they want to tell, or it's a talent they want to explore, a craft they want to nurture. And now if the money comes, that's great. If the money doesn't come, sometimes that's the end of the career, because you know, people have to support themselves, and not everybody can be a writer with a second job.
Yes, I agree. Most of my author friends have second jobs, third jobs, multiple streams of income, and many are professors at universities. And yes, to building relationships, I completely agree with you.
I think that's true, but I'll go back to my point, which is since I'm not profit-oriented, although now I really have to be in terms of, you know, payroll and overhead and so forth. This has been a particularly, I mean, we're halfway through 2021 and we've already almost reached our whole 2020 income level. And 2020 was the best year financially we ever had. So I'm not sure where this is going. And I honestly think that it is a fluke of a year. I didn't think it's the new future, you know, the new Poison Pen. Just a lot of things that came together. For example, a lot of books were postponed from 2020 and moved into 2021. So it's a difficult year to manage from a supply side and a promotion side because there's just this enormous crowd of titles. But because of the way we do our events, our Zoom events, all of our author events are conversations. We don't ever put an author up, you know, with a microphone and say, go to it. Authors are not necessarily entertainers. And since I used to do a lot of trial work, you know, as a lawyer, I really love to not cross-examined. That's a little unfair, but I really like it. Well, it sort of is. I really like talking to people, and others on my staff over the years have learned how to do it. So Patrick Milliken, who's been working, I mean, he's into almost near 30 working for me. He has his own audience and his own set of authors, and he does things. Patrick King, our science fiction selector, he runs a kind of whole science fiction fantasy program that he loves. John Charles on our staff, his real interest is in romance and nonfiction, a lot of interesting things. He's now running, and he set it up, and I pay no attention to it, a whole Sunday morning book chat program where, you know, he has conversations on Zoom, and we podcast them, and we put them up on either YouTube or Facebook or something. So, you know, gradually the staff of each acquired their own audience and their own expertise.
And I'm sure having all of this in place made the transition during the pandemic to your events going completely virtual made it a lot easier.
Oh, we did all that for the 20 years before COVID because we always just transmitted stuff. We live streamed stuff with the video camera directly from our live events to Facebook. So changing it to Zoom didn't matter at all.
You are ahead of the curve. Now, let's talk about the book clubs at the Poisoned Pen. Members join the club of their choice, and the cost of the book of the month is charged to their credit card. But you also offer club memberships as a gift. Can you tell us a little about the book clubs that you offer? Because you have a great selection.
Well, thank you. I think we have to distinguish. We have some book discussion clubs, three of those, and those are on topic. One of them is for traditional mystery. And one of them is for hard-boiled crime, and then one of them is for science fiction and fantasy. But the book clubs you're talking about are basically once every month, mostly me, select a book and charge it to your card and send it to you, and it's a lovely surprise that comes in the mail. I've seen subscription boxes, and you know, there are various stores that offer groups of books, but we have found that offering a new book a month really works well. And it is a very nice surprise. It's like the old Harry and David Fruit of the Month Club, you know, when you signed up and you got Paris one month and Peaches the next. So we have a crime club, which is a kind of general best book of the month in an overall category. Then we have a cozy crimes club because there are people who are very fond of that particular subgenre. There's a British crime club because, again, people are very fond of that. We have an international crime club because crime writing over the last 30 years has really taken off globally. You now get many more books in translation, much more original crime fiction written in different languages, Japanese, Germans, well, you know, the whole Scandinavian, Scandi noir, whatever, Nordic noir, whatever you want to call it. I mean, even Australia, although it's written in English, it's almost a different language. And, you know, they have a whole industry that has really grown up and is now independent, really, from Britain. It used to be Australia got all its books on ships from London, but now they have their own publishing stuff and do really well. New Zealand coming along. And we have a science fiction and fantasy book of the month. But then we have one because we're not really a mystery bookstore. We started out as one because I thought we needed a specialty. I'd learned from my training in law that to be a general lawyer anymore, like being a doctor with a broad practice, it's so specialized. It's really hard to keep up with all the knowledge. So there was a big string of mystery bookstores. There might have been 30. I mean, it's a lot of mystery bookstores back in the 80s when it was such a popular genre. Now it's dwindled away, and I think there's maybe 10 or 12 of us or something. But anyway, so crime was what I loved, mystery. My mother loved mystery. I built the store in part for her so that we could do that together before she died. And we had a lot of time together. But now we do all kinds of things, as I mentioned, science fiction and romance and women's fiction and nonfiction and Southwestern fiction and history and you name it. So we have a club called Notable New Books, and it's specifically not a science fiction or a crime, or it's something I find that I really think is significant and people would love. And we've had some remarkable choices over the years because we did this before it became a thing. And so we got a lot more help from publishers. It's a lot more competitive today, you know, and the club memberships vary. But it's a great basis upon which to interest people. Oh, and then the one that is the biggest one, oddly enough, and probably in many senses the most important from my standpoint, is the First Mystery Club. So it's for first novels. And all of them have to be autographed first printings. First edition is actually a misnomer. It's the first printing of the first edition that's collectible. And they all have to be autographed except for the International Crime, which obviously, you know, wouldn't work out. The British Crime, again, would be really tough. The Cozy one can vary. And the science fiction one can vary, but First Mystery Club, Crime Book of the Month, Historical Fiction Book of the Month, and all, they have to be autographed. And that's often a real challenge. You know, you have to chase down the author, you have to get the publisher involved. And they're not as big as they used to be. Book collecting took a huge leap when John Dunning wrote a book called Book to Die, which is still an absolute classic, in which people looked at books as collectibles, you know, like art and art prints. And that infused the whole world of publishing, especially crime fiction, with this fervor for, you know, collecting valuables and making investments in books and so forth. Well, publishing's changed a lot. There aren't that many first novels with very small printings, very few. I once bought half the entire first printing of a book from a small publisher. Another store and I, we just, you know, bought the whole thing. And that was like 500 or 600 books or something. And today, you know, probably more reasonable to think it might be 100 to 200 books for something like that. But it is a nice signal for attention. And authors like being in the club, obviously, it's flattering to them.
It sure is. Now, the bookshop offers fantastic events. For example, authors such as Jake Tapper in conversation with David Baldacci and Lee Child in conversation with James Patterson and President Bill Clinton. These author conversations hosted by authors are wonderful. Was this your idea and how have they been received? And I'm guessing you have viewers from all around the world.
The audience is incredibly global. I was really surprised when Karen Slaughter, who's a great bestseller, asked me to do an event for an Icelandic author that she's very fond of, who, you know, we knew about, but had not been a significant sales for us. And so we did, and we had 9,000 people watching it, and something like 190 of them were U.S. citizens, and everybody else, you know, you can tell from somewhere else. I'm very populist about this. I don't do tickets. Our sales, we actually most of the time sell out of the books in question. So we don't ticket our events. They are available free on Facebook. It's nice if you buy one, but that's not really our purpose for doing them. It was my idea way back in the beginning. We probably did maybe in year two, so it would have been 1990. Probably our second author event, because we had very few then. It was hard to convince New York that Scottsdale was actually a place to sell books because, you know, they were looking out over the Hudson towards Los Angeles and they didn't really see anything underneath.
They bypassed Arizona.
Yeah, well, just saw right over it. But it took quite a while to make Phoenix a significant literary stop. But anyway, I could tell on this like second event that the author was floundering. And I thought, well, this is what I know how to do. You know, I've been on my feet in court for a long time. So I popped up and started talking to the author. And I thought, okay, that's the way we're going to do this from now on. And so it's either me or one of my staff. We always have read the book, you know, which let me tell you, when you watch the Baldacci and Tapper, the first time that we did that in May, we had a technical problem. David couldn't sign in. And I found myself sitting there preparing to talk to Jake Tapper for an hour, you know, without David Baldacci. So if we didn't have you have to have read it and be able to do this in place, it would have been a disaster. But it's just what I knew how to do. And that's what we're known for. So sometimes we have other authors hosting. But if you look over our many hundreds of videos now on Facebook and YouTube, or listen to the almost 100,000 downloads of the podcast. A lot of the time it's just me or it's just Patrick. And, you know, the truth is, if the author really wants the sole focus of the event to be on him or her, then it's way better to be talking to me or Patrick or Pat or something. Because if you have another author, inevitably, to be courteous, you know, you wind up talking to the other author too about their work. I mean, they're not there just to be a stooge. So it diffuses the focus somewhat. Sometimes it's great, Lee Child is a brilliant interviewer, for example. J.T. Ellison is very good. There are British authors who are terrific that when we're doing a British author event, I often ask another British author because there are differences, you know, in the culture and how things are perceived that I might get wrong. I've had Australian authors together where I think it would be great, you know, to Emma Fischick and Solari Gentle have done a Michael Robotham, who's a wonderful writer.
Yes.
Mystery set in Britain, but he is Australian. So, you know, it just depends. Sometimes publishers ask you to have a host. You know, there's no, you have to be really flexible to do this.
And with the success of these virtual events, do you see yourself continuing with some kind of a hybrid format, even as parts of the world reopen?
Well, we always did stream them. So, you know, there's nothing different. I have a live event this evening and, you know, we have to find the camera because probably haven't looked at it for a while. But anyway, yeah, it'll still be there on Facebook and so forth. But the thing is, and Zoom has allowed us to do a lot of events by putting authors together or visiting with authors in place. They were never going to come to Scottsdale. For example, I've been asked to do the book launch for Lord Jeffrey Archer in his U.S. edition in October. Now, tell me seriously, do you really think he ever would have come to Scottsdale? And we're the same age, so I'm really delighted to do this while we both can still do it. I wish that, you know, there were a number of authors I would have given anything to have had a conversation with, and these tools weren't available. Dick Francis, for example, would have been, or Ruth Rendell. We had P.D. James to the store and all, but there are a lot of authors that would have been remarkably wonderful to have been able to use Zoom.
And of course, with the influx of virtual events, it's given the opportunity for more readers to be able to listen in on conversations with their favorite authors and tune in from anywhere in the world.
Right. And then, you know, the hardest part of doing Zoom events is the time zones. Nobody can ever figure out the right time. So, you know, I've learned to tell them what time zone it is their time when I send them the Zoom link. One of my most challenging days, I started with Camilla Läckberg in Stockholm, Sweden. And then I switched to an Australian author. Can't remember who that was. But anyway, now I'm in Australia. And then at 6 o'clock, I launched Brad Thor from Nashville. And, you know, you can't do that kind of thing, live, but you can do it on Zoom. We've done the book launches for Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child since, I don't remember, 2010 or something like that. Lincoln doesn't travel. So we've had Doug in the store and we've had Lincoln on a big screen in the store. And then we've live streamed both and, you know, or Facebook them both and put them out there. So, yeah, I have every intention of being hybrid. We'll do pure Zoom events or we'll do live events with the video component. I don't anticipate ever doing a live event without the video because we just never have done that.
As a bookshop owner, I'm sure you would be lost without your wonderful booksellers. And you've mentioned them a little bit earlier, but can you tell us a little bit more about them, please?
Oh, they are wonderful. And what's great is that everybody has different tastes. And so the store kind of grows according to, I'm the chief buyer. I'm also the person who, you know, arranges most of the events, but when they want to do one or suggest one, that's great. All of my staff are able to order books, you know, on their own and recommend them. But during the pandemic, probably 94% of our sales were internet. And normally 70% of our customers don't live in Arizona. So we've always been kind of like Amazon, except it's not an algorithm. It's real people who are picking your books. So they order, you know, they can go to the website and order any book at all. And sometimes we're directed towards books by customer enthusiasm. You know, I see every day, I just did the orders for this week. And I saw a number of books that people had ordered that I'd never heard of or that none of us had ever generated. So it's customer driven and it's bookseller driven. And then there's me who tries to keep track of the big overall picture. I work very closely with telephone sales at all the publishers. It's easier for me than having somebody come and see me, partly because the time zones are so different. It's during daylight savings time. We're 8 hours from London and 3 hours from New York. And you know, I have to get up at 5 to get anything done. So it would be really difficult to have people come and call on us. So instead, we work with telephone sales teams. So as I said, Patrick was very much interested in noir and hard-boiled, but he also grew up here, so he's very interested in Southwestern books and does a lot of nonfiction, loves true crime. Then we have Pat, who's the science fiction and fantasy guy, but he likes a lot of other stuff. And John, who runs a romance and women's fiction program and very interested in history. Karen, who has training in counseling and so forth. She's doing a program in July about a book. I can't remember the at the moment, but anyways, it's a book about basically counseling or it's a self, I can't remember if it's a self-help book or something similar. You know, so, I mean, it just depends. One of my favorite events last year, I talked to I'm trying to remember his last name. Anyway, the author of Owls of Eastern Siberia or authors of the Owls of the Eastern Ice, whatever it was called, because A, I've been there and B, I speak a little Russian and I thought that would really be fun. And we just did a program for Sir Roderick Flood about England's magnificent gardens because I've been to most of those and I really love them. And he has an economic approach to gardening and how much money it makes and how it always did. So that was fabulous. And, you know, all kinds of stuff. And then we have conversations sometimes on topic, like Jane Ann Krentz and J.T. Ellison and I did one recently on the Gothic, you know, the rise of the Gothic, which is the big new thing at the moment. Martin Edwards and I have talked about classic crime. He's the editor of the British Library crime series, which Poison Pen Press published in S-Source Books does. Leslie Klinger, who's a real expert on Sherlockian stuff, but he also is the editor of the Library of Congress crime classics, which we started as part of Poison Pen Press. And then the, trying to remember, the Horrors Writers of America, they also have a classic series, The Haunted Library. So we started 3 classic crime programs as Poison Pen Press, which I love. And I like having conversations with the editors of those series about the classics. So you asked me if I had a favorite book to recommend. And I would say that my big recommendation would be to read these classic reissues. The British crime one will introduce you to lots of writers that you might never have heard of as compared to, say, Agatha Christie or Marjorie Allingham, for example. Josephine Tay, who is often overlooked and is in many ways my favorite of all the Golden Age crime writers. I would recommend The Franchise Affair to anybody. And The Daughter of Time is her best known book, but I think some of the reasoning in it is a little wobbly, but you can't go wrong with The Franchise Affair, which is, if you really think about it, it's one of the most original of all the Trust No Ones and all of the unreliable, well, not an unreliable narrator, but it's truly a Trust No One book. In the same way that Scott Turow's Presumed Innocent is really a classic of Trust No One, people think of it as a legal thriller, but it actually was far more controversial than Gone Girl ever was. I did a Scott's book event. He's from Winnick, Illinois, too. So, you know, and also went to law. So he wrote a book called 1L, which is a real classic about law school. But I pointed out to Scott that, you know, that Presumed Innocent is one of the great Trust No One classics. I've had people argue at the checkout counter over who actually did the crime in Presumed Innocent. And so he made it so tricky, a lot of people can't even figure out exactly what happened, which I love.
Barbara, in listening to you speak today, you often referred back to your legal background. So I'm wondering if you miss your legal work, and does it have any sway in the books or the genre that you like to read?
Well, it doesn't really inform my reading, but I was an editor for Poison Pen Press for 20 years and all, and logic has to be a big part of plotting crime fiction. You can't get away with, you know, ridiculous stuff. It can be far-fetched, but it has to at least be plausible. Legal training teaches you to think sequentially. It trains you to say, what if, because lawyers really come into play when things go wrong. You don't need a lawyer when things are going well. You need a lawyer in times of crisis. Somebody dies, somebody's injured, somebody, you know, there's a conflict, somebody sues you, whatever. And so lawyers are brought in for that, but lawyers are also brought in to try to anticipate events like that and, you know, look forward to it. I mean, an easy example would be a prenuptial agreement. You know, and it's a sad thing to think about going into a marriage with dissolving it on your mind. But we've seen a recent spate, for example, of billionaire divorces. And those could be really ugly if there hadn't been some sort of agreement or negotiation or something. Well, that same skill set applies to editing books, but it also applies to running a business. I mean, you know, Patrick has been with me forever, I mentioned before, although Karen was my original hire, part-time hire 28 years ago or something, and is still with us, said to me something about, he thinks that the reason we've done so well is that I'm such a risk taker, but I am a managed risk taker. I never bet the whole enterprise. I'll say, you know, all right, somebody wants to do something new. We need to do something new to grow, because you can't stay in a rut if you want to be successful. What can we afford to lose if it doesn't go well? So, you know, you don't ever want to say, you know, the whole place is going to go if we do this thing.
And before we started the interview, you were explaining to me a little bit about reading the law, which I had not heard about before. I have a son who is a lawyer, but I've not heard of this reading the law, and I'm intrigued. Is it similar to getting a JD degree now?
I lived in Virginia at that time, and the Virginia Bar Association did have a read the law. I already had various academic degrees, and, you know, it seemed like I just didn't want to go back to school. There was a local judge who was perfectly happy to act as a, you know, sort of mentor professor. If you read the law, you can explore the avenues that you like, and you get a lot of practical experience. So in southwestern Virginia back then, there was no legal aid. I mean, we're talking the end of the 1970s here or so. I mean, it's a long time ago. So a capital case, a murder case or something, was kind of rotated around formal members of the bar. There weren't public defenders per se then. And, you know, they made you hardly any money. So the judge I worked with was allowed to qualify me to do whatever he thought I could do. And I really loved trial work. I mean, I would have failed tax law. I mean, I'm not mathematical. So I've never actually signed a check for the poison pen. I knew from the beginning that I was not the right person to be running the financial side of the bookstore. So, you know, we have a CFO. We have our own CPA. The store now has an investment account. And because we've made so much extra money that we've been able to invest it. And, you know, that's great for the year that we don't make any money. Hopefully we'll still be okay. So I've always hired people to do the stuff that I knew I wasn't any good at. I am the opposite of a micromanager. And that's hard for some people. We've lost staff over the years because I don't give them enough guidance. I bring them in and say, here's the job, and, you know, let them do it. Not everybody wants to work in an unstructured environment. So, you know, there's been a lot of successes, but some failures. But now we have a full-time manager. I did realize that we gotten too big for this system to continue. And I'm also getting a little older, don't have as much energy. And also I'm just busier because running the events program or doing all the orderings with a full-time job. So we have a great new guy who's been managing the store now for a couple of years. And when I say that, there's just a lot of everyday stuff that you have to do. Somebody has to call the air conditioning company and get them to, you know, see if we're going to make it through the summer. And somebody has to do the staffing, and somebody has to deal with policies. And, you know, and now we have a new corporate attorney because we've got to get our corporation. I mean, we've been a corporation all along, not a not-for-profit, but an S corp, which is a tax thing I won't go into. And so now I have to meet with him, and we have to bring the corporation up to date. And my exit strategy, because you really have to think about that after 31 years and at my age, is I'm giving the store to my staff. So I've just given 10% of the stock, which I own entirely up until now, to some of them. And when I die, or when I finally just say, you know, that's it, or when they tell me that I'm past it, because that's a condition for the manager. He has to tell me when I can't do this anymore, because I don't have any interest in retiring. You know, then I'll own the store, and what they do with it is going to be totally up to them. It'll be really interesting. It'd be sort of interesting to retire and see what they do with it. But on the other hand, I'm not really sure I want to do that. So we'll see. Maybe I'll make 85 the target. You know, when I'm 85, who knows?
Oh, I think you'll still be doing it when you're 95, Barbara.
You know, I mean, if you own your own company, there is no requirement, you know, that you do that. But we'll see. It's grown in directions under COVID, strangely enough, has been in many ways the most biggest business driver that we have ever had. We were totally prepared for it, not intentionally, but entirely by accident because of the way we operate. And so, you know, we now have, you know, on average, anywhere between 1,500 and 3,000 people watch what we do. Our highest audience, I think, was 59,800 for one event. What does that mean? Does that mean that a lot of these people are still going to watch us when more live events come on? Are we going to keep that big audience? The thing about doing it the way we do it is once those videos are posted on Facebook, you can watch it anytime from any place. You're not ticketed. You're not missing the performance. If you couldn't make it at 6 o'clock on Tuesday night, well, let's say 7 o'clock tonight, which is when we're doing this small live event to sort of put our toe back in the water. If you don't live here, if the time is wrong, if you were already booked, if you're watching the Suns tonight play, you know, which any reasonable person in Phoenix would certainly be doing as opposed to a book event, you can watch it anytime, you know, and that creates this amazing long sales tale where people, you know, can go on and think about it. And my husband's idea of the podcast was just genius. And that's the same thing he does. And he's got all the equipment and he loves doing it. Yeah, I told him he would get to 100,000 downloads by this summer, and he's practically there. So I think by the end of August, he will have kicked into that. And that's, again, that's free. That's for people who are driving in their cars. They're not, you know, you can watch Facebook videos on your smart TV. You don't have to be sitting at a computer or holding your phone. You know, you can direct it to your television, make popcorn.
Don't you just love technology?
I do. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Barbara, for taking time out. I know you have a busy schedule, and I always say time is our most precious resource. Spend it wisely. So thank you very much for being here.
Oh, it was a real pleasure. I'm always love, you know, talking about the store and hoping that it gives other people ideas. You know, bookstores are, each one of them is so different. It's a function of its community, what the community wants. So geography plays a role in it, but culture does as well. And it's a function of its staff. And then it's a function of sometimes bookstores have missions. We made a decision, for example, not to be political, because that's been a tough call over the last 5 years here in America. But we decided, you know, we are really there as an entertainment venue or a learning venue. And to go political would be counter our mission. So we don't do that. We don't go into huge social issues. I mean, June was, you know, Gay Pride Month. So we have a display for Great Pride. You know, we've done books, whatever. But, you know, we're not activists. And a lot of bookstores are. And again, that depends on the community. If we were in Berkeley, I'd probably feel differently. There's another bookstore here in Metro Phoenix that's much more active in social issues and causes and so forth than we are, but they have a different constituency because they started in the university town and, you know, and that's a different environment. So I think the real trick to running a successful bookstore is to figure out your mission and then try to attract the audience that goes with it. And it doesn't have to be a geographical audience if bookstores can recognize that. But, you know, not everybody likes speaking in public. You know, our events program is because I love it. But many booksellers would find that extremely difficult, and therefore the burden's on the author, you know, or whatever it is to do the entertainment. So you can't force yourself to be a different person. You have to work out who you are and who your community is and who your staff is, and then go from there.
Or like you said earlier, give certain jobs to the people who you know enjoy doing them and do a great job.
Well, that's really true too. You know, if you try to micromanage your business. The other thing to remember if you start a successful business is that all small businesses fail with the death or retirement of the owner or the landlord gets greedy. And so you have to guard against both those things. I've taken care of the first one, and actually I've taken care of the second one. So, you know, if you want to keep people for a long time on staff, you have to give them a future. You can't have them, you know, tiptoeing around saying, you know, well, it's all over when Barbara's gone. You know, there's no future here, so I should go do something else. I've tried to make it clear to them that there is a future. They get to own the store and they get to do, you know, different things than I would do with it.
Well, Barbara, thank you so much for being here today. I know you are a busy lady, and I've just had such a great time chatting with you. Thank you. And I love your jacket.
Well, thank you very much. Yes, that actually comes from a literary lunch we did. There was a vendor there from California, and I made their day. While my staff were selling books, I went shopping. It was great. You never know. There's always the unintended consequence of things, you know. But thank you. I think the jacket is brilliant, too. Anyway, it was a real pleasure. Thanks very much for having me. Bye.
If you're enjoying the Bookshop podcast, and I sure hope you are, here are a few ways you can support the ongoing episodes. You can subscribe to the show, leave a review, and share the link with family and friends and on social media. You can also support me by going to thebookshoppodcast.buzzsprout.com, click on the small orange heart at the top right-hand corner of the page, and donate using PayPal. Thanks in advance. Now, on with the second half of the show. Mystery author C.C. Harrison knew she was going to be a writer when her mother took her to the library for the first time as a child. Since then, she's written 5 award-winning crime novels. Her newest book, A Cozy Mystery, Death by G-String, introduces us to the Coyote Canyon Ladies Ukulele Club, whose first place win in a folk music competition is jeopardized when their star player is strangled to death with a ukulele G-string. When she's not writing, Harrison can be found in the desert, the mountains, or some far-flung corner of the Southwest. Hi, Cece, and welcome to the show.
Good morning, Mandy. Thank you for inviting me.
It's lovely to have you here, Cece. Now, your stories are often set in small towns in the southwestern United States. What's the attraction of that area?
Well, I love small towns for many reasons. For one thing, there's very little traffic. But what I like the most about it is that there aren't a lot of people. You get to know everyone. And one of the things I like best is when you hear the police sirens going down the highway, you can stop at any restaurant or any retail establishment and ask what's going on, and someone will know. So for a crime writer, that is very beneficial.
Yeah, I can see how that could be helpful. And which area of the country are you living in?
I am in Arizona right now. I live in Arizona, but I have, when COVID hit, I left the city and came up to the mountains. So that's where I am now, getting ready to move back to my house.
Oh, that'll be lovely. Now let's talk about your books. The Coyote Canyon Ladies Ukulele Club mystery series are cozy mysteries with creative, quirky titles such as Death by G-String and the upcoming Don't Fret the Small Stuff. I love your titles, by the way. Is this series based on real life, the ukulele part, not the murders?
No, not the murders, but the book is mostly taken from real life. There came a time after I had my first 4 or 5 books published, one right after another, I thought I might take a little time away from writing and do something else. And I thought I might like to learn how to paint. But one day, one evening, one night, I happened to see Zooey Deschanel, you know who she is, on television playing the ukulele. And she looked so darn cute that it really, I was just fascinated by it. And then not long after that, I saw someone's 90-year-old grandmother on television playing the ukulele. And again, I stopped. I was just fascinated. And then not long after that, Heidi Swedberg, who is very well known in the ukulele world, I read in our local paper that she was coming to my local library to give ukulele lessons. And she was bringing ukuleles. So I thought, I am going to go. And I did. I signed up for the class. And when I got there, the room was packed with people, so many people interested in the ukulele. And indeed, she came in pulling a big cart full of ukuleles. And when she put that ukulele in my hand, I didn't want to give it back. I was totally hooked. And the next day, I I bought a ukulele, bought a book and a chord chart, and taught myself to play. And then I joined the Ukulele Club of Phoenix and a little group called Wednesday Girls. I did my coffee shop debut, which I have to say, nobody listens to you when you do that. They're busy eating lunch. And soon a book idea came to me. So I am sure that anybody in my ukulele, any of my ukulele buddies who read the book can see themselves or some of our friends.
That's so sweet. And you know, I'll let you in on a secret. My husband is a musician and he is also a ukulele luthier. So he designs and makes beautiful ukuleles and they are called the Ojai Valley Handmade Ukuleles.
Oh, really?
Yes. And he started the Ojai Valley Ukulele Club here in Ojai, California. And he had to leave shortly after because of his other work. But it's now flourishing. And I mean, ukulele clubs have sprouted up all over the world. I think it's great. So tell us about your ukulele collection.
I have ukuleles. I have, let me see, maybe 5 or 6 ukuleles. Everything from soprano to baritone. And tenor in between. I have 2 dulcimers. Yeah, I really got hooked. I have 2 dulcimers and 2 guitars.
I have a dulcimer too. My husband bought it for me, gosh, many years back. It's such a pretty instrument.
Yeah, true. One of the things I learned after I learned to play the ukulele is that it is such fun to hang out with musicians. They are such interesting, fun people.
Yes, they are.
Well, let me tell you another little story. Then after Heidi, then who tours, she tours the world playing with her partner, Daniel, and they were doing an event in Arizona near where I lived. And she invited me to come and we did a skit on stage where I read a scene from my ukulele book and the band, her band and Daniel did sound effects behind us. And at the end, this was totally a secret plan we had. It got to the part where I was reading my chapter where the woman, the character, smashes a ukulele on the bad guy's head. And Daniel smashed a ukulele on stage. And you should have heard the audience. They were all ukulele players. First they gasped, then they screamed, then they laughed.
Gosh, I hope it was a beat up ukulele.
It was a throwaway. She said it was an old one. It was one of theirs.
So let's get back to books. When did you start writing novels and why mysteries?
Well, I always knew that I wanted to write. I'll tell the story. It's not a long story. But when I was a beginning reader and my mother took me to the library and we took out the first book, I even know the title still. It was called Val, a Dog. I read that book and turned the last page and just knew then that I was going to write. I said to my little self, I can do this. And of course, life gets in the way and you go to school and you have boyfriends and then you go to college and all of that. So I left the corporate world early and that's when I decided I was going to start writing novels. At first I thought I wanted to write romances because that was the big thing then. But I could never come up with enough conflict in a love relationship to make a book out of it. And so I switched to crime.
And you also write under the pseudonym Christy Hubbard. And your latest books, Sage Kane's House of Grace and Favor, was released December 2020. So from cozy mysteries to Western historical fiction, what's the attraction? Why the pseudonym? And can you tell us a little about Sage Kane?
Well, the pseudonym is because going from writing mysteries to Westerns, it's a different genre. And at the time, I just thought it would be a good idea and the publisher thought it would be a good idea. But it has done nothing but confuse everything. But anyway, the reason that I like to write Westerns now, because I just love the Old West. I came west to Colorado in, well, I won't say when, but it was many years ago. And I even as a little girl, I always wanted to go to the mountains. So when I was a big girl and went to the mountains, one of my favorite things to do was visit ghost towns and old mining towns. And they're everywhere in Colorado. And I would go there and imagine what was going on back in the day. And the Sage Kane book just absolutely came to me. And I have to say, it came to me whole and complete and was channeled to me as I was writing it. That only happens once in a lifetime, if at all.
Yes, you spoke about this in an article. I think it was called All Bets Are Off. And you talked about how you like to be organized, use index cards and plot. But with this particular book, Sage just told you her story. How long did it take you to complete this book?
Well, I'm a slow writer anyway, and it usually takes me a year to write a book. And with this book, for some reason, I took a break in the middle of writing it and picked it up at a later date. But altogether, it was probably a year. It was like watching a movie. All the characters came to me. All the settings came to me.
It's wonderful when that happens, but it's also odd when it ends. It's kind of like saying goodbye to a character.
Yes, it kind of is. And it's funny you should say that, because in the process of bringing a book to publication, you read it many times after it's written. And I still cried at the death scenes. I still was very emotional at the emotional scenes in the book, even now.
And can you give us a short synopsis of the story?
Yes. Let me preface that with all of my books feature strong women. And I don't mean kick-ass kind of women. I mean strong-minded women. Sage Kane left her home in St. Joseph, penniless and in debt, after she was left at the altar by a fortune-hunting scoundrel. And she had an inheritance from her aunt. It was a hotel in a town called Fairplay Creek, Colorado, based on the real town of Fairplay Creek. But when she gets there, she finds out it is not a hotel, it's a bordello. And she does not want to be a madam. So she comes up with an idea to turn the parlor house into a different kind of entertainment venue. Well, I will tell you one more thing. The reason she decided to stay, first of all, she had no money to leave anymore. And she did have a woman friend that she met on the trip who she hired to take care of the hotel. The next morning when she woke up, her friend Odie showed her all the money that had come in from the previous night. That's when she decided to stay and build up her finances so she could go back home, which she never does. She stays and she turns the bordello into a house of grace.
And let's talk about your writing process. You love music. So I'm interested if when you're writing, do you listen to music or do you prefer silence?
I listen to music. And what I listen to mostly is Dr. Jeffrey Thompson's Creative Mind series. And I still play the CDs. And it is a series where he has produced this music and incorporates bodily sounds into the music, like brain waves and your blood rushing through your veins and breath and all of that. And he's created it to stimulate creativity in a person's mind. And it really works for me. I don't know, it might not work for everyone, but it works. And when I'm not listening to that, I play chill music.
And what can you tell us about your perfect reader?
Well, funny enough, at book signings, when people buy a book, they have often told me that they're buying it for their 90-year-old grandmother or even their 90-year-old grandfather. But basically, my characters are all my female characters are all in the age range of 30-ish. And I think that is probably the age range of my readers.
Well, at ages 30 to 90, that's a large scope. Now, what is one book, apart from your own, you'd like to see more people reading?
There are so many books that I could name. I won't. But since I became a reviewer for a New York Journal of Books, I've read a lot of books. Fortunately, I get to choose the ones that I want to review. So the best books coming out of publishing today are from small publishers. And I can name, if I may, three books that still stand out for me during my reviewing. One is The Current by Tim Johnston. One is No Exit by Taylor Adams. And one is The Guilt We Carry by Samuel Gailey. These are the absolute best books I have read in the last 3 years.
Yes, so many of the small and medium presses are giving the larger publishers a run for their money. But of course, distribution is key.
Yes, and that would be the problem sometimes. But I have found that the big publishers, although they say they want something different, they want the same thing they've already published, it's the smaller publishers who will let writers take a risk along with them. And I pay particular attention to contest winners. And so many of them these days are coming out of the small publishers.
Yeah. And before I go, I'd just like to ask you a couple more questions about your writing. Do you write every day? Are you a morning, an afternoon, or an evening writer?
I am not a person who can write in little bits of time. I need an entire day. And indeed, I get up in the morning and go right to the computer to work. And I work until 3 o'clock when I take a break and go to the gym or whatever. But I work all day long, sometimes into the night. I had a friend writer, a friend of mine who was a writer, and she would write for 10 minutes at a time because she was homeschooling her kids. I don't know how she did it, but she would write for 10 minutes, go do the kids, and write for 10 minutes. I need a big chunk of time and no distractions.
Yes, and with a pandemic, it's definitely change the way people are writing and when they can write. I mean, some people at the very beginning of lockdown were just incapacitated. They just couldn't write anything. And others wrote more than they have ever. So it's interesting.
For me, I have to say that being cooped up and shut down or whatever they call it, you would think that there'd be a lot of writing that would get done. And for me, it did up to a point when I just got really tired of wearing a mask and not being able to go get my groceries and things like that. I am in a small town, so there's not a Fry's supermarket on the corner. I have to drive 35 miles to get groceries. Then it got to be a little pain. But I have to say, when somebody tells me that they have writer's block, in my mind, I'm thinking there is no such thing as writer's block. It's lack of planning. Because I am one to plan out my books in my head first and then on my index cards. So I know the beginning, the end, and the high points of the plot. I don't always know how to get there, but that's where the creativity comes in.
And what books are you currently working on?
Actually, I'm working on 3 things right now. I normally do not do that, and it is not beneficial to me, but just as it happened, I am working on a mystery suspense called Death of a Two-Timing Man. I had to interrupt that book because I had an invitation from another publisher. So I am now working on another Western called The Women of Cheater Mountain. And my 3rd ukulele book, which is still swirling in my mind, will be called Fretboard to Death.
Another great title. That's a funny one.
Well, let me tell you one more story then, if we have time. The ukulele books almost did not get written. But one day I was at a conference and sitting next to Katrina McPherson, if you know who she is. And she asked me what I was working on. And I had no characters, no plot, nothing. I just gave her the title of Death by G-String, and she just jumped out of her chair and she said, write that book. So then I wrote the book, and on the cover of the book, it says, Death by G-String, Coyote Canyon Ladies Ukulele Club Mystery. So it's a ukulele theme book. There's a ukulele on the cover. There's a music stand that says ukulele practice. And on the back, it tells a little bit about the book. And that is all the information my publisher sent to Amazon. So Amazon thought it would be a good idea to put my book in the same category as underwear.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, is why you shop at independent bookshops, because they know what they're doing.
Yes, exactly. And at first I was very upset about it. But then I thought, well, you know, the title, you know, is anybody looking for underwear will find my book.
That's true. And your website is ccharrison-author.com. Lovely chatting with you, Cece, and maybe I'll see you at the Poison Pen.
Thank you. I love talking to you, and I'm so happy that you invited me.
Make sure to follow me on Instagram and Facebook at The Bookshop Podcast. To learn more about upcoming speaking engagements, my books, and my Art of Observing workshops, go to my website at mandyjacksonbeverly.com. You can sign up for my newsletter or contact me directly at mandy@cricketpublishing.org and follow me on social media at Mandy Jackson Beverly. Read global, buy local, support your local indie bookshop.